Dun, dun, dun. Welcome back to the Batuta Advocate Radio Show. I had to do it. I'm sorry.
It's all right, mate.
Peter, I had to do it. You're joined by myself, Clancy Overall, and Wendell Hussey.
Yep.
And of course, if you didn't gather from my very cringeworthy pun at the top, we're talking to Peter Garrett today. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure, mate. Mates, good to be here.
It's great to have you here. I would say great influence on this newspaper.
I hope so.
Yeah, you are. You are very much so. Great influence on Australian rock music. And, you know, you've had a storied career. You're back now on your second solo album.
Yeah.
See how I jerked that back before I started talking about politics. You're on your second solo studio album, True North, it's called. What's the process like nowadays?
Well, it's either going to happen or it isn't.
Yep.
After all this time. And you'd learn that maybe it won't. Mm-hmm. And then you're in the wilderness for a while and it's all a bit dry.
Yeah.
And sometimes it does happen. Mm-hmm. And you got to grab it when it does.
Did you have that? Some people had different responses creatively to the pandemic. Were you one of the blocks or were you one of the streams?
Yeah. So I was probably an outlier really in the pandemic.
Yeah.
I didn't quite get the jump onto line and start singing straight away and sharing everything with everyone.
To save everyone, yes.
I get that people needed to do it for their own mental health or emotional well-being, but it really wasn't for me. I felt a bit guilty at times because I thought, at last, you know, I can actually stop and get a chance to do other stuff quietly. But then, of course, it started to take effect on people around me and then we entered into this phase where we were being quite tightly regulated. Mm-hmm. Part of me bridled at that, but part of me thought it was a good idea.
Yeah. And it was both.
Yeah,
It was a great idea and it was a pain in the ass.
No, that's totally right. Yeah, yeah. You know, and if you look at the stats, we did brilliantly.
Yeah.
You know, we did really well. I mean, Trump murdered, you know, 10 million of his own.
Yeah. You forget the scale of it all in countries with populations like that.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And we did very well. But then, of course, it caught us, you know, it sort of caught us because we snuck in and did a bit of playing in the middle of it, which we got away with, but it was a little expensive.
Yeah.
And then both Rob Hurst and I got it.
Yep.
But, of course, it was the gig. We got it in Adelaide and, of course, we were playing in Darwin and all the gear had gone to Darwin. So that was
Darwin entering the territory during the pandemic was like going through customs, wasn't it?
No question.
Yeah. I remember that when we went to Alice Springs just back at 2020 and they were like, you'd have a harder time getting into America.
One road in, one road out.
Easier time getting into America. Yeah, one road in, one road out.
Yeah.
And they take it very seriously, as do Queenslanders. Queenslanders, you know, love a dictator deep down, and Anastasia was the one we needed at that time, according to all of those electorates in the Sunshine Coast of retired Nationals voters who just voted Labor because they enjoyed the idea of a corrugated iron curtain, some would say.
Just arresting people trying to jump the border at Coolangatta there.
Yes.
Made every Queenslander feel good. You mentioned about jumping online there, which is what a lot of people did in that couple of year period. They're still doing it. The lead single on this album, Permaglow, is about that, about people spending time on screens and getting too caught up in it all. Tell us how you came to that.
My own family. No, look. I might be late to the party, you know, in both senses.
Yeah.
Like I'm late to the party in that, of course, I use my phone and I look at stuff. You have to. But I don't spend my life on it.
Yeah.
So I don't quite get it.
Yeah.
And I'm not that fussed by people's opinions if I don't know them.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's how I've sort of seen it. So it's been a bit of a mystery game. But then I realised that a lot of people were very locked in.
Yeah.
So much so that they couldn't do anything without reference.
The term's very online.
Okay.
We're seeing a lot of that.
Are you one of those dads, Peter, that will you'll sit on the couch and then get on the phone and maybe go for a scroll, have a look in some of the random Facebook groups he's in, and then put the phone down and decide that's enough and talk to his daughters and go, hey, what's going on? Get off the phones. Let's have a conversation.
Slightly past that point, but yes, definitely I was that. Actually,
I've been a hypocrite in your past.
Yeah, no, exactly. But yeah, look, I've never liked the look of Facebook.
Yeah.
Like there's just something about it. I've never got it. I don't like it.
Mm.
I think Zuckerberg's a creep.
The first time you heard that word, Facebook, It was kind of creepy. Like the first time you ever heard that word, Facebook, and then it just kind of became a part of the landscape.
Which we're pretty thankful for, obviously.
No, we made our print run was doing perfectly well before the interns decided to make the online transition. You know, we could go back to the old days where everyone pays $2 each morning.
Yeah, well, we'll try.
Napster convinced a generation of kids that they don't need to pay for anything anymore.
I know. Yeah, tell me. I'm only too aware of that one. You could bootleg cassettes back in the day, you realise. Yeah. Remember? Oh, we've got another one. The little cassette system in the Western Suburbs. Like, hey, we got more coming up.
Yeah, bootlegs. Yeah.
We were really happy to be bootlegged because I figure if someone go to the trouble of bootlegging you back in the day, it was a physical thing.
Yeah.
They didn't have the money.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right about Napster. And I mean, the industry itself's completely busted and broken in some ways.
Yeah.
That was only the beginning of the rot.
Yeah.
Even though we've now got the Spotify's and what have yous. It's pretty hard for people.
Billy Birmingham, the 12th man, told us that he was a household name in England without knowing because of bootleg cassettes. So
I can believe it.
Yeah, every time he meets cab drivers over there, they're like...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I've never bought anything of yours, but I know...
I know you, yeah.
Please do the Bill Laurie voice. Come on. I'm going to get old mate on the phone. Can you do it for me? I did want to ask you about what it's like for current musicians or how you view it as being for current musicians at the moment. You guys didn't really get a lot of mainstream recognition when you were coming through. Radio stations actively weren't playing you, but you persevered by going to RSLs and pubs and bars all over the country, and there was an appetite for that. I could be wrong, but it doesn't seem like there's as much of an appetite for young political bands coming through now to do something like that without an online platform. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think you're probably right, Wendell. I think that, you know, it's easy to be sort of 2020 vision, rear vision mirror, dose of nostalgia.
Yeah.
It was all good. And it wasn't all good. But what it was an opportunity to play your craft and learn how to do it night after night in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And I still don't think there's much that beats that.
Yeah, and meeting your colleagues on the way.
A bit of that.
Your contemporaries.
Yeah, and it wasn't even the politics back in the day. I mean, I don't think anyone particularly, if they were interested, they didn't say.
Yeah.
And if they understood it, you wouldn't have known.
Yeah, yeah. I want to kind of go through that now because when you listen, Polly Bennett was in the studio the other day, who's a movement coach for Elvis and The Crown. So she's kind of dealt with a lot of these themes of, you know, historical, political kind of art
That'd
forms.
Be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But she kind of spent a lot of time on Elvis. And I didn't realise that it was so controversial that he was slightly political when he released If I Can Dream.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people saw the parallels to Martin Luther King.
Absolutely.
Just after that.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Very, very subtle.
Yes. And he ended up, of course, as you may have covered with her, but he ended up being a pretty right-wing redneck
character
in his back end.
Yeah,
like, well, he wasn't like Johnny Cash, you know?
No, not a Christian anarchist like Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
But, you know, Elvis had a profound respect for Martin Luther King, and that was how he communicated that. I would say Midnight Oil was perhaps a little less subtle than If I Can Dream.
Guilty on all counts. I've got to wear that.
Do you feel like that was it was unprecedented? You know, being
completely.
You were insider outsiders, but you ended up being quite a mainstream sound in Australia.
Yeah,
as
eventually.
Evident with the that riff that I started this podcast with, which is universal. Do you think you struck fear into a lot of people? The fact that there was kids screaming lyrics about asbestos and
I don't think so. No, none of that.
No.
I mean, you boys are too young to sort of really remember and share all the magic of it. But the truth of it is, as you did say when we were yarning in the first part of it, it took us forever to actually get into that middle space.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't actually aiming for it, but it took a long time for that to happen. And prior to that, we would just play anywhere and everywhere. Mm. I mean, it wasn't even a formula.
Yeah.
It was like, where can we play?
Yeah.
Mm.
Is there a stage? Can we put on a show? A lot of it back in the day was do it yourself, which I still look back on seriously fondly. Hard work, but well worth it. In fact, I've just come back. I've just played with the new young band, The Alters.
Yeah.
We did Waitangi Day in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know,
things are heated over there at the moment.
A little, yeah. And I allocate myself basically between one and three war stories a day. Yep. That's the limit. Now, once you get to that point, I've got to, you know, sip it. Yeah. So, of course, I had my one war story to the band. And so we were driving through a part of town and I said, yeah, I remember when we first came here. And they're all like, oh, here we go, another war story. Yeah, and I remember we did a run. We did a poster run down that street. They're going, really? You put your own posters up in New Zealand? I said, yeah. And then I remember we ran into a Maori gang and they chased us, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was do-it-yourself. We were just playing the songs. And honestly, we were just literally five guys in those days on a stage with a bunch of songs that we'd written, which we really believed in, some of which had political themes, some of which didn't.
Yeah.
And we were just up there tearing it up.
Yeah.
And it took a long time for that to mature, if you like, into something else. And to answer the question, which is really good, which is how did the industry come at Midnight Oil if it found Elvis a bit hard going when he just mentioned, you know, a light on a hill or whatever it was. The truth of it is that radio here in Australia did not play Beds Are Burning first.
Right.
They didn't play it.
Yeah.
The programmer said, look, some of them would have been to shows. They'd been down the front with the boys, you know, and they went, oh, it's probably a bit political for us.
Yeah.
We got played in Europe and the States before we got played in Australia with Beds.
And then it was reluctantly when they did.
Correct.
Yeah, right.
And that's 1986, four, you know.
Mm.
Like we're 10 years into the career.
Yeah.
What were the feelings like when the recognition did come?
Did you feel more powerful than God that you were going to, you know, change this place into this, maybe we could have even established some sort of self-determination for Indigenous people, maybe?
Well, yeah, all of the above, but not.
Who did you put on skates the most? Who do you think had to respond to what you were singing about in real time?
Look, I think by the time we got to the Sydney Olympics in 2000 and did it up there with the Sorry Suits, we were putting Howard and the government on the spot.
Yeah.
He and the Governor-General are the only two. The Governor-General had to stand up, sit down, I beg your pardon, with Howard. So Mrs. Howard and Mr. Howard and the Governor-General and the Governor-General's wife are the only two people seated in the stadium amongst 80,000 people.
Yeah, that's
true
pretty,
story.
That's pretty powerful.
Were you looking up there at the time? Or
I didn't know. No, I was concentrating on what I was doing, so I didn't stuff up.
Didn't have a glance up to just see.
Oh, actually, it's not quite right. I tend not to overthink what I'm doing,
and
I don't like to think about it too much, because
it
is a thing, and it happens, and given who I am and what I'm doing, would you really do that normally? Probably not.
Yeah.
But I had a moment when we got out there, because the boys didn't have to play, because they were worried about the wind coming through the stadium and blowing mics and things over.
Mm.
They were just strumming along quietly, but they had a backtrack. But I did have to sing live.
Yeah, right.
So the pressure was on, you know.
Yeah.
But I just had a moment before I thought, okay, here we are. This is, I don't know what's going to happen now, but I just want to try and remember this fact.
Yeah.
Plus, I never got to play footy in there or anything.
Yeah,
so I thought, wow.
Oh, this is my grand final.
Yeah.
Amen.
Can I trouble you for a second war story, please? Talking about
what you wish for.
There's no limits in the studio.
Traversing the country before the mainstream success and saying what you were saying and singing about what you were singing about. Were there any hairy run-ins? Were there a few? How did it kind of go with punters?
Not so much with punters. I mean, we've got our fair share of tales because we did such a lot of it. I mean, wasn't just us. There were probably three or four bands that were really covering the K's.
Yeah.
But ourselves, Chisel,
mm-hmm.
and probably the Angels
mm-hmm.
were the three that really, like, six nights a week, week in and week out.
Yeah.
And we'd bump into one another quite a lot,
mm-hmm.
but we'd always be on the go.
Yeah.
There was a Hell's Angels festival. You want the stories, of course, you're going to get them. There was a Hell's Angels festival.
Great opening line.
I'm hooked.
Which was held outside of Melbourne
mm-hmm.
In a suburb called Broadford.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Hell's Angels were very well organised back then. I don't know anything about them now.
Did they still have a little bit of that post Hunter S. Thompson?
Totally.
Yeah, totally. Noble savages.
Totally, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, no, they weren't fully credited, paid up members of the mafia.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they were still fearsome.
And outlaws.
Yeah. And it was one of those gigs that you never forget for lots of different reasons. But one reason was that, and the guy who'd organised it and the agent said, look, it's going to be fine and they'll take care of you and, you know, you're going to get paid. And we're like, oh, don't really know that this is our crowd, but we would play anywhere.
Yeah.
So there we were. And we got up onto the stage and I looked down and I thought, my God, what's happened? And they'd put a cyclone fence along the front of the stage, and they were all just up against it, you know, having a pee and vomiting through it, and you know, nudging their mates, and the jackets were over it with the colours on it. I thought, oh my God, and it was quite a sight. And we came out afterwards, and I said to, I said, I've got to go and have a piss after that. It was too much. And I said, where's the dunny? There's no, you know, your little portaloos outside. Yeah. I said, oh no, it's rolled down the hill. I said, what happened? He said, well, one of you blokes got in there, and you know, ball bearing came along, and he got bored, and he wanted to get in, and you wouldn't let him in, so he just kicked it down the hill. the guitarist in some Melbourne band, you know, with his floral shirt, was rolling down the hill.
Covered in shit and piss.
So, not quite as colourful when he came out.
Not to be forgotten.
No. Oh, man, that's fun. Did you ever have that feeling where, I mean, I know in the Beds Are Burning video clip, you've got a couple of Indigenous activists from Redfern who went on to... they feature in the clip, and they went on to be quite prominent in Aboriginal media.
Yeah, Tiger Bales.
Tiger Bales.
Yeah.
Tiger Bales ended up in country music radio, and he had this strategy where he would play country music to the Brisbane market, and truck drivers would listen, and everyone else would listen. People who might have their views challenged by, you know, the information in between country music songs. And it appeared to be, and it still is to this day, you know, an effective model of kind of winning people over to their cause. Did you find you having a similar effect, you know, with the punters? All of a sudden they're learning about things, or they're kind of, you know, experiencing different kind of ways of looking at things through your music?
So the answer is not in the way that you'd think. So it wasn't the plan.
No.
But the result is utterly varied.
Yeah.
And it depends on eras, age, interest, whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's an incredible thing to be... have been in a band for that long.
Yeah.
So to play to people when they were teenagers, and then they were in their 20s, and they're in their 30s, and then in their 50s.
Yeah.
And people's thinking changes over time. It's really obvious. Some people get more into the issues, and some people get less.
Yeah.
You know?
So you found, regardless of how, you know, loud they were singing along back then, they could turn 50 and start watching Sky News.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question. And some do.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, it was interesting when we did, when we were campaigning really strongly for the Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we did Makarrata. I mean, that was an album about the Uluru Statement.
First Nation. First Nation. First to deserve an explanation.
And we poured a lot into that, and I thought it was really strong, and we worked with, you know, our Indigenous brothers and sisters who just were incredible. And I would say that the fan base was maybe 50-50 there, if that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So it's an interesting argument about art and culture, because you know, I believe in it deeply. I think it's really important. You've got to tell your stories, sing your songs, say what you think. But there's something deeper and bigger going on in people's lives normally.
Yeah.
Culture and song and what they like to consume comes and goes.
Yeah.
But there's that underlying kind of foundational zeitgeist, which says what people are really thinking and how they feel about things.
Yeah.
And sometimes the two things don't add up in Midnight Oorland.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I guess you can say that lasts forever is like...
the final chord in Long Way to the Top.
There you go. Like Bob Marley. If you were once a disciple of Bob Marley, you kind of would be like that 30 years later.
Yeah, no, I reckon that's right.
Rasta thing, you know, the Rasta never dies. But that is interesting to see that, you know, to hear that. You currently only have so much influence when you're on the same wavelength, when you're in the same age, you're on the same...
Yeah, and remember, and I mean, I've said it many times before, and I've said it to you guys as well, Midnight Oil wasn't about trying to have influence. It was about trying to survive.
Yeah.
And we were just writing songs.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, I had lots to say on stage, but, you know, I'm not the only singer to get up and sort of take the mic and have a crack. And it became an experience of being political and active, and it led to all sorts of things, and eventually I ended up in government. And that was a manifestation of how we felt about something, but it wasn't to do with us trying to convince other people to think about it or believe it.
Yeah. Mm. Well, that's very refreshingly pure.
Well, you know what? I don't think there are very many political bands that we can think of around the table who've lasted the distance where it stands up.
Yeah.
Either they've fallen away on it and realised there's no audience for them, or they've ended up in these ridiculous positions pushing sort of a doctrinaire party line thing, which doesn't make much sense.
Yeah.
I mean, in the States and Europe, it's different because in the States, it's a more conservative environment generally.
Yeah.
And depending on where you were playing, like if you played in the South or Texas or the Midwest or whatever.
Like Dragon did.
Newmark very well.
Yeah.
Know about that thing a lot. But actually, we did it night after night and had our records burned and people, you know, trying to punch us out and throw things at us and all that for quite a long time. Not in any heavy way.
Nah.
But it was just there.
Yeah, just uproar. Yeah. Or outrage.
You know, I think about it now and I realise it's more the managers and the road managers and the production people who are freaking out because you're just, you know, you're just doing your thing really you're sort of, oh, a little bit more colour and movement. Yeah. It's a show.
Yeah. I mean, America kind of lives and breathes that, don't they? A little bit of...
They're funny though, you know, like it's a wonderful musical country.
Yeah.
Like it's insane. Like the musicianship, drawing on the black music legacy and, I mean, you can go into any town and you're going to hear someone doing something really beautiful and well. Even some of the alt countries, just wonderful. Mm. But when it comes to the crowds themselves, it's still a little timid unless they've drunk too much. And in that case, they're not controllable.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly because they're still pretty conflicted about whether they're still in the Wild West and it's the frontier or whether they're a modern democratic nation or whether they're heading,
The gun debate. The gun debate is an example of that. They're like, are we out here shooting bandits or are we, you know...
Shooting schools.
Shooting schools. That's it. There's a cultural kind of confusion there between the Wild West and modern America.
And you know, someone that you might sit around and have dinner with who's... someone that you might share something in common with will say to you, well, is there a problem with you being able to carry a gun openly down the street?
You can't talk to them about it.
You're sort of going, where do I start on this?
I know. You just got to go, okay, next conversation. Who would you say the most lively, we always ask, musicians that come on, where they find the most unexpected kind of parcel or enclave of fans? Because, you know, the Silverchair guys... They'll tell you about Argentina and Brazil.
Yeah,
That came down to distribution and hemispheres and stuff like that. They explained why they were so big in Latin America to us because they were doing so well in Australia and all of the Southern Hemisphere was marketed as one. So they saw the numbers in Australia and advertised them as much to Latin America. And then they became. And it's great. It's a great example of if you put something in front of someone, you know, that might be enough for them to kind of jump on board. Like the Hilltop Hoods always talk about Germany and like Denmark as their, people chanting along with them.
Yeah.
Where did you find it? And who are the most kind of reactive to your music that you can see you can play them as a crowd?
I think that...
North of England?
Glasgow?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that we've done a lot more playing than probably both of those outfits in our time. And so we built... solid audiences, but lower level audiences.
Yeah, right.
But in terms of the audiences that really lock in, we did Brazil before the Chair and had a very strong audience there. And I would say that's the case. When we came back and when I got out of the house and we decided that we'd go and do some playing and people showed up, we were a little surprised to find that so many people did in many places, but particularly there.
Yeah.
It's Portuguese is the language, you know. And they're wonderful people, and I love the culture of the place. The politics is challenging. And I had a bit to do with it in my other life, one of my other lives, when I was on the Greenpeace board. So I know how tough it is in the country. But they're wonderful people, and they love their music. So, it's pretty strong for most Australian bands, I think.
Really? Brazil?
Yeah, it's fun. But in terms of the audience that really goes, probably the French and the Germans. Yeah, right. So my wife's German.
Yeah.
Both those places, I think... got us at an interesting point. They got us around about Beds, Diesel and Dust, Blue Sky Mine, sort of that big period, big records, MTV back in the day.
Yep.
And a marriage of music and politics, which they could get.
Yeah, the winds of change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're pretty strong.
Mm.
In terms of total nuts, maybe the Finns, you know, but that's... maybe not anything to do with you. It's the fact that you only get a chance to play there for about a week.
There's all these different communities popping up in the cities, like Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne, of young Europeans.
All right.
So apparently the Scandinavian boys are all coming out in droves.
Oh,
because they're such good tradesmen because they have to work fast because they only have about 4 months a year.
That's right.
And apparently they're on work sites around Australia now being told to woo up, you know.
And they're used to their saunas and stuff, so they don't mind sweating it out.
No, exactly. Yeah, no, it all feels good.
They're not knocking off because it's over 35.
Yeah. So when they're on the fins, yeah.
Speaking of your other life, Peter.
Speaking of challenging politics.
Yeah. Before we go there, can we talk about the Nuclear Disarmament Party, please, and your first stint there? What was the conversations in the background for you to have a crack at the Nuclear Disarmament Party Senate ticket?
Oh, look, it was really just thinking that, you know, the current state of play was not smart at all and really difficult to comprehend why we'd get ourselves into that state. And Australia buying into it without thinking, really. Yeah,
a bit like AUKUS.
Yeah, well, we'll come to that too, won't we? So some things never change. I think globally it was a really interesting moment because a lot of young people were coming through and saying, look, we just don't think this is – it's completely irrational, mad, nuts scenario. I mean, you can look at Dr. Strangelove, that great film, which sort of sums it up really well. But the truth of it is that nuclear weapons were actually based in Germany in particular and other places that are part of NATO. There were many, 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 many more of them than were ever conceivably being used. I'd seen the effect when I went to Hiroshima when the wars recorded over there. So I thought, this is shocking what these things can do. And that was a tiny nuclear weapon. You also had a lot of ex-military leaders, generals and admirals and things who sort of realised when they were in there, hang on a minute.
Well, yeah, Oppenheimer, right?
We
think there's a chain of events here that's beyond our control.
What are we going to do?
Yeah.
You know, and that's why they took the briefcase away from Trump when he was president.
I didn't know that.
No, they literally did.
Oh, really?
Actually, we were in the States. This is amazing. We were in the States when he was president. He was musing about what he was going to do, and it was about South Korea or something crazy. And within about 20 minutes, the chief, it wasn't Miley, but I think it was the one before him, the chief of the Defence Forces came on the air, like right across America, and just stood, you know, with all his uniform on, looking at the camera and said that we are not going to be attacking anyone with nuclear weapons. Yeah. You know, there are serious safety protocols. You know, just laid it out, i.e., I'm sorry, we've got a mad president, but this is not going to happen.
Yeah, like we just can't let that
happen. We just can't let it happen because they've thought about it. So those sorts of people were putting up their hands and saying this, we've got to de-escalate.
Yeah.
Little groups were starting up around the country, and there was a group in Sydney involved, and they came along and said, oh, we need a candidate, and you're pretty well known because running around in the pubs. And I'd written a bit about it. I'd started to write a bit about it. So
what you were saying before, right? Being a political band was not the plan. Influencing people was not the plan. You were just political people making music.
Correct.
Audiences may have been political, may not have been. Yeah. But, you know, when you then have to become the face or, you know, a member of an actual political movement, did you feel like the oils were helping there, or did you feel like it was a new set of skills you had to learn?
I think the media thought that it was, you know, lay down Mazaire, you know, because on the one hand they have a stereotypical view of entertainment, like they keep on calling you a rock star.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand they have a stereotypical view of politics as well, which they still have vis-a-vis Nemesis.
Yeah.
So you were in the reality zone, which was not neither much. Yeah. The odds were incredible. You know, I mean, we played through that whole campaign and did shows, and we had a bit of a yarn about how we would do it and what I would and wouldn't say, and they were supportive, but we didn't want to turn them into big political rallies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we just tried to sort of thread that needle for a while, and I didn't get much sleep.
So we've got Newcastle, 12th of March, Canberra, 14th of March, Factory Theatre. Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
15th of March. Melbourne's already sold out for one of the nights. Hindley Street, Adelaide. 23rd of March, Perth, Regal Theatre. 28th, Tanks Arts Centre, Cairns, Heavenly. 30th, at the Tivoli in Brisbane, the Tiv.
God what bless. A crescendo.
There you go. And Bluesfest.
And Bluesfest, of course.
Yeah.
And that concludes part one of the Batuta Advocates interview with Peter Garrett, former Midnight Oil's frontman, as we discussed there, and a political figure from the 2000s in Australia at a federal level. As you can tell, the conversation was flowing, and we went on for quite a while, which is why we've decided to split this one up into two parts so you can listen at your own leisure. Tune in for part two, where we discuss a whole range of things. Peter Garrett's time in Parliament, his feelings on the last government, which, you know, coming from a man that was in Parliament at a time that was rather rocky, Scott Morrison's, with all the different portfolios and all the different dramas, made Peter Garrett's time look quite stable, and it's great to hear his take on it. We're also talking about what he wishes he could have done as a politician, and what got in the way and what needs to be done, as well as delving into this new album. So please, tune into part two.